This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Lesson number 32, Surah Al-Baqarah, Ayah 234-242. وَالَّذِينَ يُتَوَفَّوْنَ مِنْكُمْ. And those who are taken in death among you. وَيَذَرُونَ أَزْوَاجًا. And leave wives behind. What should those wives do? يَتَرَبَّصْنَ بِأَنفُسِهِنَّ أَرْبَعَةَ أَشْهُرٍ وَعَشْرًا. They shall wait 4 months and 10 days. Over here we see, in these verses, some more rulings pertaining to talaq have been given. Different scenarios have been presented in different cases of divorce. How is a woman to be treated? What should be given to her as compensation? And besides the issue of divorce, the matters pertaining to widow have also been mentioned. They have also been detailed. Because we see that divorce and death are two reasons which separate a husband and wife. So what is a woman supposed to do in the case where the husband dies? So in this ayah, the case of the widow has been mentioned, that if a woman, her husband dies, then what is she supposed to do? We learned earlier about the mutallaqat, about the women who have been given divorce. Now specifically, the case of those women whose husbands have passed away has been mentioned. That وَالَّذِينَ يُتَوَفَّوْنَ مِنْكُمْ. Those men who are taken in death among you. The word yutawaffawna is from the root letters waw, fa, ya. And the word wafa means to fulfill something, to fulfill a promise. It is to reach the end of a term, or it is to reach the end, the completion of something. From the same root, the word tawaffa, whose verbal form you see over here, yutawaffawna, tawaffa is to take something fully. What does it mean? To take something fully, to take something completely. And from this, the word wafat, as you may have heard, is used for death. Why? Because when a person dies, his soul is taken fully. It is removed fully from his body and also out of his control. He does not have any control over his soul anymore. So, وَالَّذِينَ يُتَوَفَّوْنَ مِنْكُمْ. This means those who have been taken fully among you, meaning those who are taken in death among you. Those men who die, whose ruh has been taken away. So those men who die, and minkum has been said, among you has been said, because you all refers to believers. So if any Muslim man dies, and when he dies, وَيَذَرُونَ أَزْوَاجًا, and they leave behind wives. يَذَرُونَ is from the root letters وَاو ذَال رَ. وَذَرَ is to leave something or someone in their state as they are, to abandon something in its state as it is. So those men who die, and they leave behind themselves أَزْوَاجًا. أَزْوَاج is a plural of زَوْج. Zawj, as you know, is used for spouse. Over here in particular, it refers to wives. So what does it mean by this? That they leave behind wives. Basically, they leave behind women with whom they have nikah, whether one or more. One wife or more wives. One, two, three, or four. How many ever wives. Whether the marriage was consummated with them or not. What does it mean by that? That whether only the nikah took place or both of them were living together for the past 20 years. So whether the marriage was consummated or not. Whether the mahr was given or not. What does it mean by that? That at the time of marriage, the mahr has to be given to the woman. But sometimes, because of some reason, the mahr is delayed. For example, the man says, within 20 years I will give you this much. Or within 5 days I will give you this much. This is the mahr. So the mahr was given or the mahr was not given. and regardless of the age of the woman, whether she is 20 years old or 45 years old, no matter how old she is. So if a man who dies leaves behind a wife, one or more, whether the marriage with her was consummated or not, whether he had given her the mahr or not, no matter how old or young she is, if he is leaving behind him a wife who is now a widow, what is that widow supposed to do? What is that wife supposed to do? يَتَرَبَّصْنَ. They have to wait. And يَتَرَبَّصْنَ over here gives a sense of an amr. It is an instruction that is being given. It is a command. Meaning they don't have any choice with regards to this. They must wait. They must remain in the waiting period. And يَتَرَبَّصْنَ, as you know, is from تَرَبَّصْ رَابَصَ, which means to lie in wait for a term to be over, for a particular time. So the women have to wait in عِدَّة during the waiting period. And what do they have to do? They have to stay on their own, meaning they have to refrain from getting married. They have to hold themselves back from getting married again. يَتَرَبَّصْنَ بِأَنفُسِهِنَّ, with themselves. So we see over here that it is natural for a woman to have the desire to be married. So therefore, in the state of عِدَّة even, she has to stop herself from getting married. For how long? How long is a waiting period? أَرْبَعَةَ أَشْهُرْ, 4 months. أَشْهُرْ is a plural of شَهْر. And these months are lunar months. They are قَمْرِ. So these are lunar months. So she has to wait for 4 months, and not just 4 months, وَعَشْرَ, and 10. What does it mean by 10? Meaning 10 more days and nights. So the waiting period of the widow has been mentioned over here. And what is that? 4 months and 10 days, which is a total of 17 weeks and 5 days, which is about 130 days. So the woman has to stay in waiting for this period of time. We see that divorce and death both cause separation between a husband and wife. And both of these cases, whether it's divorce or it's death, it is very difficult emotionally for a woman. Even in divorce, it's the woman who has to suffer emotionally, or it is extremely burdensome for her. And therefore, the woman needs time for her to be able to transition from her previous relationship to the next relationship. She needs time on her own. She needs time to get herself back together, to get over this wound that she has suffered. And this time, she is to spend on her own without being socially active. Why? So that she can transition from her previous state to her next relationship. And we see that regardless of her age, the widow has to stay in عِدَّة for this period of time. And she does not get married during this time. Why? So that her pregnancy may be revealed. The period of 4 months and 10 days has been set so that the pregnancy of the widow may be revealed. We learned that the period for the مطلقة is 3 menstrual cycles. Why? Because there is the opportunity of رجوع with regards to the طلاق الرجعي. But here in particular, it's different and it's longer. Why? So that specifically the pregnancy can be revealed. We learn from a hadith which is mentioned in Sahih al-Bukhari that إِنَّ خَلْقَ أَحَدِكُمْ يُجْمَعُ فِي بَطْنِ أُمِّهِ 40 يَوْمًا نُطْفَةً ثُمَّ يَكُونُ عَلَقَةً مِثْلَ ذَلِكَ ثُمَّ يَكُونُ مُضْغَةً مِثْلَ ذَلِكَ ثُمَّ يُبْعَثُ إِلَيْهِ الْمَلَكُ فَيَنْفُخُ فِيهِ الرُّوحِ. The creation of a human being is put together in the womb of his mother in 40 days. In how long? 40 days, which is more than a month. In the form of a seed. And next, he becomes a clot of thick blood for a similar period. So 40 days, and then another 40 days, it becomes into a clot of thick blood. And next, a morsel of flesh for a similar period, another 40 days. And then Allah sends an angel who is ordered to breathe life into the fetus. So we see that 40 days is the first stage, then the next 40 days, then the next 40 days. How many days? 40 times 3, 120. Add 10 more days to that. How much is that? 130 days. And I told you earlier that 4 months and 10 days is about 130 days as well. So we see that after 130 days, the fetus is given the ruh. The fetus has ruh in it. And once the fetus has ruh in it, obviously it's going to start movement. And with the movement, the pregnancy is going to be determined. So therefore, the iddah of the widow is 4 months and 10 days. And if the woman discovers that she is pregnant, then her iddah will continue until she delivers her child. Why? Because as soon as a mother, as soon as a woman delivers, what happens? All of her attention, all of her focus goes to the child. She forgets about the pain that she has gone through. She forgets about everything else that's going on, and all that she can be concerned about is her child. So therefore, as soon as a woman delivers, then her iddah is over. Whether it is after 1 month that her husband has passed away, or it is after 9 months. But her iddah will be for how long? Until she delivers her baby. And we learn this from Surah Al-Talaq, Ayah 4, that وَأُولَاتُ الْأَحْمَالِ أَجَلُهُنَّ أَنْ يَضَعْنَ حَمْلَهُنَّ. And for those who are pregnant, their term is until they give birth. So in this ayah, we learn that a woman whose husband has passed away must stay in iddah. Iddah is mandatory upon her. We learn from a hadith, which is in Sahih Muslim. The Prophet ﷺ said that it is not lawful for a woman who believes in Allah and the last day that she should mourn a dead person for more than 3 days, except in the case of her husband, whom she should mourn for 4 months and 10 days. So we see that mourning after the death of the husband is something that is mandatory for a widow. Why? Because if you think of it, if a woman gets married, let's say only the nikah took place, and very soon she's supposed to move in with her husband, and she finds out that her husband has passed away in an accident, how would she feel? How would she feel? This would come to her as a big shock, and she might become very depressed. And so she cannot just go and live a normal life, be socially active, continue her daily chores, her going out, going and meeting people, or she cannot even get married immediately. Why? Because she needs to get over the grief and get over the state of shock that she has been. And we see that time is the best healer. So she needs time to move on. And this is the reason why men are also not allowed to propose the widow during her iddah. Because she needs time on her own. She needs to be on her own to get over the stage. And if a woman does get married right after the death of her husband, then what's going to happen? She may be physically living with one man, but emotionally and mentally, she may be elsewhere. She may be living apparently a happy life, but the grief, the shock that she has undergone, it's going to affect her. So she needs time on her own in order to be able to adjust to her new life, to her new circumstances. So we see that there is great wisdom in the iddah of the widow. And people could come up with many benefits, great wisdom. However, the most important reason is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who has appointed the iddah for the widow. And because Allah is all-knowing, He is all-wise, therefore He has appointed 4 months and 10 days. A person might wonder, 4 months and 10 days. Why 10 days? Why not just 4 months? There is wisdom behind that. This is Allah's decision. This is the ruling that has been given to us by Allah. As we learned earlier, وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ وَأَنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. Allah knows and you do not know. Also we see that after the death of the husband, there may be many issues that the woman has to deal with, that the widow has to take care of. For example, she may have to go deal with the financial issues of the husband, which is why she might have to go to the bank, or she might have to go to the court because of the division of the estate. Similarly, if she works with her husband, if she's a part in his business, then she might have to deal with all of these issues. The house, she has to take care of that. The children, she has to take care of them. So the death of the husband puts a lot of responsibility and work on the wife, and she needs time to deal with all of those matters. She needs time on her own. If she is pulled from every direction, come to this party, come to that wedding, okay, she might dress up and go happily, but she's going to be burdened with the work that she has to do. Emotionally, she may be very hurt. So she needs time on her own to deal with all of these matters as well. Therefore, their iddah has been appointed for the widow. And we learn from the Quran and Sunnah that during their iddah, the widow has to observe certain rules and regulations. What are they? That first of all, as we learn over here, يَتَرَبَّصْنَ بِأَنفُسِهِنَّ. A woman, a widow, is not allowed to get married during her iddah. She stays on her own as a single until her iddah is over. Secondly, we learn that a woman during her iddah, the widow, is not allowed to adorn herself or beautify herself. Why? Because this is part of the mourning. A woman has to mourn for 4 months and 10 days. And this is part of the mourning that she is not allowed to adorn or beautify herself. Now, what is included in adorning and beautifying herself? Such as wearing jewelry, wearing makeup, wearing colorful clothing. Because if you look at it, a woman basically dresses up, she adorns herself for who? For her husband. Now when the husband is not there, when the husband has passed away, then she needs a time in which she is not going to dress up, she's not going to beautify herself, she's not going to adorn herself, so that if she gets married afterwards, she's had that stage in which she has been free. So she adorns herself basically for the husband. And during their iddah, she is not going to adorn herself. She is not going to beautify herself. And it doesn't mean that she is not going to keep herself clean. No, she is to keep herself clean. But adornment, wearing jewelry, this is not permissible. And sometimes we see that women, they have a habit of wearing their typical jewelry, a few rings, some earrings, a necklace, and bracelets. Even this is not permissible during their iddah. So if a woman has been wearing her gold bangles for 2 years, for 5 years, for 10 years, when her husband dies, in the state of iddah, she is supposed to take them off. She is supposed to remove them. Also we see that when a woman adorns herself, why does she do that? Either for the sake of her husband, or at a happy occasion. Isn't it so? Women who are not married, they get dressed up when? On Eid, at a party, when going somewhere. So it's basically at a happy occasion. But when a woman's husband has died, that's not a happy occasion at all. So therefore, she is supposed to remove the zina. She's not supposed to adorn herself anymore. We learn from a hadith in Sahih al-Bukhari that Salama said, that a woman said, that O Messenger of Allah, my daughter's husband died, and she is complaining about her eye. Should we put some kuhl in her eye? Kuhl is like the black stuff that you put in your eyes. So she asked that, can we put that in her eye because she's complaining about her eye? And the Prophet ﷺ said, no. And each time that he was asked, but she's complaining about her eye, each time he said, no. And then he said, it is 4 months and 10 days and nights. During the Jahiliyyah, one of you would mourn for an entire year. So now their iddah is 4 months and 10 days and nights. Therefore, in this time, you may not adorn yourself, even to the extent of putting kuhl in the eyes. Even this is not permissible for a woman in her iddah. Also, A woman in her iddah is to stay in the husband's house for the entire duration of their iddah. Meaning she is to spend their iddah where? In the house of her husband. Now some people think of this as an unreasonable restriction. What if the man and woman were living on their own? How can she live on her own now without the husband being there? But the fact is that was the house of the woman. She has many memories, many good times, many good moments that she spent over there. First of all, her husband has passed away. Then secondly, you're taking her out of her house. It's extremely painful for her. Let her be in her own place, on her own, for some time. Also, we see that because that is the house of the woman, all of her things are there. All of her clothes, her books, the things that she uses, all of them are there. If she is told that you have to leave right away so that you can spend there in your parents' house, or in the house of your sister, in the house of your grandparents, then what's going to happen? What all is she going to take with her? It's going to be very difficult for her. So therefore, a woman is to spend their iddah in the house of her husband. Also, we see that another restriction upon the woman is that during their iddah, she is to stay at home and she must not leave the house to go anywhere. Unless in the situation of extreme necessity. But mainly, a woman is to stay in the house during her iddah and she is not to go anywhere else. And if she has to go somewhere, then she must return and spend the night in her house, in the house of her husband. If she has to go somewhere during the day for some work, she has to return home and spend the night where? In her house. Now, what is included in necessity? In what situation is a woman allowed to leave the house? What are those situations? First of all, we see that these situations include, or these necessities include, for example, if a woman is sick, she needs to go visit the doctor, she needs to go for her test or for some checkup. So in this situation, she must leave the house. The doctor is not going to come. Similarly, because the woman has to deal with a lot of financial matters, a lot of other matters when her husband has passed away, therefore, she might have to go to the bank, she might have to go to the court, she might have to go do some work, return some amana. So therefore, in this situation, she is allowed to leave the house. Similarly, if the children are very small, and she is the only one who can drop them off at school, who can pick them up from school, who can bring the groceries for the children, then in that situation also, she is allowed to go, provided that there is nobody else who can do that for her. Because a woman is going through a very difficult situation. She needs time on her own so that she can do ibadah, she can do dhikr, she can collect herself together. If she is told to continue with her daily work, then it's going to be very difficult for her. She might go into depression. So, other people, the relatives, the father, the brother, the sister, the mother, they are supposed to help her. The father-in-law, the mother-in-law, the sister-in-law, they should be supporting her. But if she is on her own and there is nobody else who can help her, then she may leave the house to get the groceries, for example, or to do some other important work. But obviously, when she leaves, she must remember that she is in iddah. So she should limit her interaction, she should limit her adornment to the best of her ability. Also, we see that another necessity in which a woman is allowed to leave the house is if she has to continue work or she has to begin working. Sometimes we see that a woman used to work before her husband passed away. The husband used to bring a paycheck and she used to bring a paycheck. Now, the husband is not there. He's not working. And if she does not work, how is she going to support herself or her little children, very young children, if she doesn't work? So what is she going to do? She needs to continue working. So in this situation, she is allowed to work. Similarly, in other situations, what happens is that the man is not working, but the woman is working because of whatever reason. The man is unemployed for some time, and the woman is the only one who's been working for some time. So if she stops working, How is she going to support herself? How is she going to support her children? So in this situation also, she is allowed to work. If she is the one who used to run the business, who used to work, then she is allowed to work. But a woman must also look at the situation that she's in. Can she make do with less? Can she make do with the support of her parents or with the inheritance that she has received of her husband? If she can, then she should not work. But if the situation is such in which she must work, then she is allowed to work. Similarly, sometimes a woman may be in a country where she receives benefits for being a widow. So if she is receiving some benefits from the government, then in this situation also, she should not work. We learn from several narrations that some women were allowed to go work in their fields, despite the fact that their husbands had passed away. So, in a situation where there is no option for you, you have to work, you must work to support yourself, to support your young children. If it's a necessity, then a woman may continue work or a woman may begin working. But she has to look at her situation as well. Similarly, a woman may be studying. Maybe she was a student. And if she sits at home for her iddah, what's going to happen? Maybe her exams are coming up. Maybe her semester is coming to an end. If she stops studying, if she stops going to school, if she stops going to university, it's going to affect her entire year. It's going to affect her entire semester. So in this situation also, she may go for her work, for her class, for her course, for her exam, and return home immediately. Because many times we see that women, they go out to do one thing and they end up doing 5 extra things. But she should only leave the house for that particular purpose, and as soon as that is done, she should come back home immediately. And she should limit her socialization with others. Now remember that necessity does not include going to weddings. It does not include going to parties, going to social gatherings, or even going to lectures. Because these events, they're social events, and a woman can do without going to them. It's possible that there is a wedding that is coming up in the family. Your own niece or your own nephew is getting married. However, if a woman is in her iddah, then she must not leave the house. Then she should stay in the house. Necessity is a situation in which a woman has to go. And if she does not leave the house, then she will suffer. If she does not go to a wedding party, then she's not really suffering. She may miss out on some fun, but in fact that is better for her because she is in the state of iddah. Now some people might say that a woman is already suffering because of the sadness that her husband has passed away, and then she's told to stay in iddah, she's not to go out and distract herself. So isn't that going to add to her depression? A person might think like that. The fact is that it might. However, she needs time on her own to get over the previous stage of her life. And if she distracts herself by these temporary things, then what's going to happen? She's not going to be able to completely get over that stage. It's just like using drugs. If a person uses drugs, temporarily, he might feel happy. But after some time, the problem is going to come back to him. And he might be in a situation that is much worse. So we see over here that a woman has to stay in iddah after the death of her husband. And she has to observe all of the restrictions that have been imposed on her. فَإِذَا بَلَغْنَ أَجَلَهُنَّ Then when they have reached their appointed term. What does it mean by this? That when their iddah is over, when the 4 months and 10 days are over, فَلَا جُنَاحَ عَلَيْكُمْ Then there is no sin upon you. Who does you refer to? You refers to the wali of the woman. Those people who are responsible for her after her husband. So there is no sin upon you, O awliya, fima, concerning what? Fa'alna, they did, fi anfusihinna, concerning themselves, بالمعروف, in the manner that is appropriate. What does it mean by this? That after the iddah, if a woman decides something for herself, if it is an appropriate decision, if it is correct, it is ma'roof, it is acceptable to the aql, to the culture, to the society, to the religion, then there is no sin upon the awliya of the woman. But which decision is this that the woman is allowed to make for herself? We see that a widow, because she was previously married, she has more authority with regards to her affairs than a virgin, than a woman who has never been married. We learned earlier that a virgin cannot marry without the consent of her awliya. And in the case of the woman who was previously married, whether divorced or widow, she makes her decision and the wali just is there to perform her marriage. She cannot go marry on her own. Obviously the wali is going to perform the marriage, but she is the one who makes the final decision. It's not her wali. So she is allowed to make a decision for her marriage after her previous husband has passed away. So basically over here is an indication that if a woman decides to get married after her iddah, then this is not something that is wrong. Many times, in many Muslim cultures, it is considered wrong for a woman to remarry after her husband has passed away. But we see that in some situations, it is better for the woman to get married. Why? Think of it. If a woman has young children, how is she supposed to continue working and support the children, provide them good education, provide them a loving house, a house where the mother is there to take care of the children? How is she supposed to do all of that on her own? She needs somebody else's support. And emotionally also, she needs someone else's support. Imagine if the woman is very young. Imagine if she's in her early 20s. Imagine if she's in her late teens and her husband passed away. She was still very young. Is she going to remain single for the rest of her life? No. She needs a partner as well. She needs somebody to rely on as well. So therefore, if a woman decides to get married after their iddah, then this is not something that is wrong. It is not something that is incorrect. Rather, she is allowed to do so. So there is no blame upon you, O awliya, if she decides to get married. And remember that when a woman decides to get married, how does she do that? Or when she's thinking of getting married, what does she do? She adorns herself or she beautifies herself. She goes to social gatherings, tries to meet other people. Obviously, I'm not saying over here that she goes and tries to meet non-mahram men. Obviously, that's absolutely haram. That's incorrect. Unless if it's in an appropriate way that somebody introduces a man to her and all of us are aware of that. So, if a woman, after her iddah, continues to wear zina, to adorn herself, which is an indication to her relatives, to her family, that I am ready to get married. So if she does something like that, there is no sin upon the relatives of this woman, because she has decided for herself that she wants to get married. Ibn Abbas radhiyallahu anhu said that if the woman is divorced or if her husband dies and then her iddah term ends, there is no sin that she beautifies herself so that she becomes ready for marriage proposals. This is the way that is just and honorable. So he explained this as the ma'roof. What is ma'roof? That a woman, she beautifies herself so that she becomes ready for marriage proposals. Now it doesn't mean that she decks herself up when she goes outside. She doesn't care about hijab. No, that's obviously understood. But what it means is that after the iddah, when she was not beautifying herself, when she was not adorning herself at all, now all of a sudden, she has become interested in clothes, in makeup, in jewelry. What does that mean? That she's looking for a spouse. So if she does that, there is nothing wrong in this. There is absolutely nothing wrong in this. But obviously, she should make the decision honorably, in a manner that is correct, in a manner that is appropriate. And obviously, she should remain within the limits of the Sharia. وَاللَّهُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ خَبِيرٌ. And Allah is with whatever that you do, always all aware. Everything that you do, Allah is aware of that. The name of Allah, Khabir, is from the root letters Kha, Ba, Ra, from the word Khabr. And Khabr is to know. It is to be aware. It is to be acquainted about the reality of something. It is to be aware of the Zahir and the Batin matters, of the apparent and the hidden. That He doesn't just see as to what you do on the outside, He knows what you are thinking, what you are feeling inside as well. So when the woman thinks that she needs to get married, she thinks that it's better for her to get married, Allah knows about that. We see over here that the commands with regards to the widow have been given. The rulings with regards to the widow have been given. And these rulings, the Muslims, the believers, have to observe them. But at the same time, these rulings also abolishing some of the jahili practices. The commands that we have been given, at the same time, they were also abolishing some of the jahili practices. What does it mean by jahili practices? The practices before Islam, the pre-Islamic time. We see that before Islam, the widow would remain in iddah for an entire year. For one whole year. And this was before Islam and also at the beginning. Initially, the Muslim women also were supposed to remain in iddah for an entire year. But in Jahiliyyah, when the women were in iddah, they were not allowed to dress up at all. They were not allowed to adorn themselves. Obviously, this is something that continued in Islam. But in Jahiliyyah, they were not allowed to adorn themselves to an extent that the woman was not even allowed to comb her hair, or to bathe herself, or to clean herself. So she would just not be emotionally in a miserable condition, but even physically, she would be in a very miserable condition. We learn that Zainab, the daughter of Salama, she said about the pre-Islamic era of ignorance, that when the woman's husband died, she would go into seclusion, complete seclusion, completely cut off from the rest of the world. But we see that in Islam, when a woman is in iddah, she is allowed to talk to other people, she is allowed to go out to fulfill her need, but she has been told to limit. But in pre-Islamic time, when the woman's husband died, she would go into seclusion and she would wear the worst clothes she had. She would refrain from wearing perfume or any adornments until a year passed. She would then come out of seclusion and would be given dung that she would throw. Then an animal would be brought out, a donkey, a sheep, or a bird. Then some blood would be drained from it, usually resulting in its death. So we see that the widow, she wasn't considered as a normal human being anymore. She was cut off from the society, and when she was brought back, some weird practices were also done, such as killing an animal, or throwing dung and things like that. And after the iddah, the woman did not have the liberty to make decisions for herself. If she wanted to get married again, she was not allowed to decide for herself. And sometimes she would be forced into a marriage with someone. She would be forced into a marriage. She would not want to get married, but she would be forced into it. And other times, the woman would be inherited by the heirs of the dead man, just as his camels were inherited, just as his property was inherited. Similarly, the wife was also inherited by the heirs. That just as the brothers of the dead person would take his camels, would take his house, similarly, the wife would also be inherited by one of them. Which is why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed in Surah An-Nisa, ayah 19, that يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا يَحِلُّ لَكُمْ أَنْتَرِثُ النِّسَاءَ كَرْهَا. O you who have believed, it is not lawful for you to inherit women by compulsion. Women are not some property. You don't inherit them. After the death of the husband, the woman has the right to decide for herself whether or not she wants to get married and who she wants to get married to. But we see that even today, In some cultures, after the death of the husband, the woman is not allowed to live a normal life anymore. And unfortunately, this is not just in un-Islamic cultures. To some extent, this is also prevalent in our Muslim cultures, within our Muslims. In un-Islamic cultures, we see that the death of the husband means that the woman must also be burnt alive with the dead body of the husband. Yes, this is a practice that was practiced up until recently and perhaps even today. Allahu A'lam. Similarly, we see that when a woman, when her husband dies, she's not allowed to remarry. She's considered as somebody who's going to bring bad luck. So she's not allowed to come to the weddings of other people. She's not allowed to wear colorful clothes. For the rest of her life, she's going to wear simple clothes. She's going to wear white or she's going to wear black. She's not going to put on colorful clothing. And she's not going to come into social gatherings, because if she comes, she's going to bring bad luck. So all of these practices have been abolished by Islam. The woman, when her husband dies, she's going to wait for 4 months and 10 days. If she's pregnant, her pregnancy will be revealed. And at this time, she gets time on her own to get over the state of shock, to get over the state of grief. She needs time to collect herself together, to get herself back together, and to deal with all of the matters that have fallen upon her now. And after her iddah, she is allowed to get married. So the conclusion of this ayah is that their iddah is for 4 months and 10 days. And secondly, the widow is granted security and independence to make her own decisions. Therefore, she should not be forced to marry someone whom she does not want to. And if she wishes to marry someone, she should be allowed to, as long as it is with bil ma'ruf. Let's listen to the recitation.
والذين يتوفون منكم ويذرون أزواجا يتربصن بأنفسهن أربعة أشهر وعشرا فإذا بلغن أجلهن فلا جناح عليكم فيما فعلن في أنفسهن بالمعروف وَاللَّهُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ خَبِيرٌ.
We see that sometimes even within Muslims, if a woman's husband has passed away, she is discouraged from marrying afterwards, after her iddah. And if she does get married, people consider that to be very strange. However, it may be better for her in her situation. If she has young children, she needs the support of someone else. And if her young children are looked after by another person, by another family, that gives them an opportunity to look after orphans. And the house in which orphans are treated nicely, they're treated with affection and care, that's the best house amongst the Muslims. And the house in which the orphans are not treated properly, they're not treated with affection and care, that's the worst house. So if a woman decides to get married after her husband has passed away, there is absolutely nothing wrong in that. وَلَا جُنَاحَ عَلَيْكُمْ. And there is no sin upon you. There is no blame upon you. Who does you refer to? The men. Which men? The men who wish to marry the widow. Those men who wish to marry the widowed women. There is no blame upon you. Meaning you shouldn't feel guilty. You shouldn't feel guilty with regards to what? Fima, in what? عَرَّضْتُمْ بِهِ مِنْ خِطْبَةِ النِّسَاءِ. There is no blame upon you for that to which you indirectly allude concerning a proposal to women. Fima عَرَّضْتُمْ. عَرَّضْتُمْ is from the root letters عَيْنْ رَا ضَاد. And the word عَرْض, it means to display something. ثُمَّ عَرَضَهُمْ عَلَى الْمَلَائِكَةِ. Arada means to display something, to present something, to offer something. And from this, the word arada, ta'rid, arattum, the word that you see over here, ta'rid is to hint with regards to something, to give an indication only about something, to talk indirectly. One is that a person says something very clearly in a straightforward manner. And the other is that a person only hints it. He speaks about it in an unclear way, in an indirect manner. And this is the opposite of tasrih. Tasrih is to state something clearly, to be straightforward with something. Over here, فِيمَا عَرَّدْتُمْ, what does it mean? That you indirectly hint. You indirectly allude. Of what? مِنْ خِطْبَةِ النِّسَاءِ, of proposal of marriage to the women. خِطْبَة is from the root letters خَطَبَة. And خِطْبَة is to ask a woman for marriage. To ask a woman in marriage. It is to send a proposal of marriage to a woman. This is what khitbah is. And khitbah is also used for engagement. Why? Because engagement is the acceptance of the proposal. Right? Engagement is only the acceptance of the proposal. Remember, engagement does not mean nikah. Because many times people think that if they are engaged to someone, then there is no mahram na mahram issue between them. They think that talking is permissible, sitting together is permissible, there is no hijab that is required anymore, that they can go out together. No. Khitbah is only engagement which is the acceptance of the proposal. That a woman is proposed and she accepts, so obviously both are now engaged, now they just have to decide as to when they're going to get married, where they're going to get married. So khitbah over here means proposal. Proposal to who? An-nisa, the women. Which women are these? The women over here refers to the widow in particular, but it may also be applied to divorced women. It may also be applied to divorced women, but primarily in the context it refers to those women whose husbands have passed away. So, there is no blame upon you, O men, if you indirectly hint a proposal of marriage to the women, when? During their iddah. Because remember that when a woman is in her iddah, she cannot get married. And a proposal cannot be sent to her directly. But a man can hint the proposal to her in direct way. What does that mean? How will that be done? We see that, for example, a man may say to the woman that inshallah, Allah will bring a father for these children soon. What does that mean? That he is hinting that she could get married after her iddah. Similarly, a man may say to the woman that I wish to get married. He's not saying that I wish to get married to you, but he's just saying, I'm thinking of getting married. Especially if he's a relative to her. Or he can mention it to her relative. For example, the man could say to her relative that when her iddah ends, let me know. So you can indirectly hint the proposal during their iddah. We see that amongst the Arabs, marrying a second time, that if a person was married, they got divorced, so marrying again, or marrying a widow, was not something that was considered wrong. It was not something that was looked down upon. Many times we see that within Muslims even, if a woman is divorced or a woman is a widow, nobody will even think of sending a proposal to her. She is considered as somebody who is used, or she is considered as somebody who has her baggage with her, so you cannot get married to her. However, this is something that is not in our deen. In pre-Islamic times as well, and even after Islam, this is not something that was looked down upon. Getting married a second time or marrying a widow. Islam permitted this. Why? Because in this is benefit for the woman. How can she spend her entire life alone now? Sometimes we see that women at a very young age, they get divorced. Or at a very young age, they get widowed. And just because she is divorced or just because she's a widow, nobody is going to send a proposal to her. But Islam has allowed this, that you can marry a woman who is widow. But certain guidelines have been given. What are those guidelines? That nikah cannot take place during their iddah, and direct proposal of marriage cannot be given during the iddah. The proposal may be hinted, and I mentioned some of the examples to you. Or aknantum, you all concealed. Aknantum is from the root letters kaf, noon, nun, kan. And kan is to keep something secret. It is to keep something from sight. It is to hide something so that it remains hidden, nobody can see it, and it remains a secret. It is to hide something in a secure place. Now, something that you hide in your heart, is it secure? It's secure. The moment you say, or the moment you write something, then what happens? It's not secure anymore. Somebody could hear it, or somebody could read it. But if you keep it in your heart, it's secure. It's safe. And if you decide not to reveal it, nobody can find out about it. So aknantum is that you hid, you concealed what the proposal were in your heart. That you don't say it, you don't mention it, you don't even hint it. You just hide it fi anfusikum in your hearts until when? Until their iddah is over. So there is no blame upon the man if he decides to hint the proposal indirectly during their iddah, or he decides to wait until their iddah is over and then he sends the proposal directly. So basically, a choice has been given. You can hint it during their iddah, or you can wait until their iddah is over and send the proposal directly. Alimallahu, Allah knew. So why has this permission been given? Because Allah knows that annakum, that indeed you, satadkurunahunna, you are going to mention them. You are going to think of them. What does it mean by this? That you are going to think of marrying them. Even during their iddah. You will think about marrying them. So therefore, he has allowed you that if you're not able to resist it, then only hint the proposal. And if you can resist, if you can hold yourself back, then wait until their iddah is over. We see that many times, something that a person intends to do, or a goal that he has, what happens? You cannot keep it to yourself only. Sometimes it's a simple thing as going somewhere on the weekend, and you just have to tell somebody about it. And if you don't think it's appropriate to tell them about it, you at least hint it. It's something that is natural. We like to express, we like to share our intentions, our goals, what we want to do, what we plan to do. So because this is something very natural, Allah knows about it, that you are going to mention them, you are going to think of them, you are going to think of marrying them. Therefore, He has allowed you that if you wish to send the proposal indirectly, do that. And if you wish to wait until the end of their iddah, you may do that. So He knows that you're going to mention them. And sometimes, this dhikr can refer to just thinking about marrying the woman, or this dhikr refers to sending the indirect proposal, or talking about the intention to marry that woman. So Allah knows that you're going to do that, therefore He has allowed you, therefore there is no sin in taking either of the options. Walakin, but there is one restriction, that la tuwa'iduhunna, do not promise them, do not make any promises with them of what? Of marrying them. When? During their iddah. Tuwa'iduhunna is from the root letters waw aindal, from the word wa'da. What does it mean? Promise. So don't promise them, or don't make the women promise you. That don't make the woman who is a widow, who is in her iddah, don't make her promise you that give your pledge to me, or promise me that you shall not marry anyone else except me. Promise me. And sometimes, if a woman is not even in her iddah, if a man wishes to marry a woman and he's not able to immediately, what does he do? He forces the woman to promise him that she is only going to marry him. What does Allah say? لَا تُوَعِدُونَ. Don't make the women promise you that they must marry you only. And notice how Allah says, لا تواعدوهن سرا, secretly. Because such promises can only be made in secret. You cannot make this promise in front of her father, in front of her brother. No, you can't do that. So, لا تواعدوهن سرا. Do not make them promise this in secret. Some have said, the لا تواعدوهن سرا refers to don't marry them in secret. Don't do nikah with them in secret. إلا except أن تقولوا قولا معروفا, except that you say a statement that is appropriate. Again, what does قولا معروفا refer to? That you only hint the marriage proposal. You don't say it directly. For example, a person says to her wali that do not give her away in marriage until you inform me first. Now, why is a person not allowed to make the promise with the woman that he is going to marry her after her iddah? If you think of it, if a woman finds out during her iddah that there is another person who wishes to marry her, this might bring comfort to her. She might think, okay, I'm not left on my own. There is somebody who loves me. There is somebody who will take care of me after my iddah. But men have been forbidden from making these promises to the women or directly proposing the women during her iddah. Why? What's the wisdom behind that? What if the man changes his mind afterwards? Who is going to suffer more? Who is going to get more hurt? The woman. So 4 months and 10 days is a long period of time. So therefore, do not make any promises, because you never know how you might feel, what you might think after the iddah is over. So don't make any promises. Another wisdom, another reason is that because this promise is going to cause disturbance in the iddah of the woman. She is already disturbed mentally. She is still recovering from the death of her husband. And now somebody else comes and tells her that I'm going to marry you. Who should she think about? Her dead husband or her prospective husband? And she's going to be completely divided. Or should she think of herself? So therefore, do not disturb the woman in this stage. Leave her. Don't disturb her. You should wait until the end of the iddah. وَلَا تَعْزِمُوا عُقُدَةَ النِّكَاحِ, and do not resolve the legal contract of marriage, the عُقُدَةَ of nikah. تَعْزِمُ is from the root letters عَيْن, زَي, مِيم, from the word عَزْم. And عَزْم is to make a decision with regards to something, to make up one's mind about something, and it is to make a firm resolve, firm decision, that this is exactly what I'm going to do and I'm not going to do anything else. So don't resolve, don't decide, don't determine the عُقْدَة of nikah. عُقْدَة is from عَيْن قَافْ دَال, literally means tie, a knot, and from this the word عُقْدَةُ nikah is used for the contract of marriage, the marriage contract. So don't resolve the marriage contract. What does it mean? That don't decide to marry them. Don't make the final decision during the iddah. So over here, the command is being repeated. It is being mentioned in another way, that you may have the intention to send the proposal directly, to marry that woman after her iddah, but do not make a firm decision in your heart. Because you never know that you propose to her after her iddah and she refuses. It's possible that she refuses. She says, no, I need more time. I don't wish to get married right now. Or I do not wish to marry you. So don't make a firm decision in your heart of the عُقْدَة of nikah, حَتَّى until يَبُلُغَ الْكِتَابُ أَجَلَهُ, until the prescribed period reaches its appointed term. يَبُلُغَ الْكِتَابُ. Now what does the word kitab mean? Book, isn't it? But remember the literal meaning of the word kitab. It's from kat, which means to join together. Kataba is to write something. And from this, kitab is used for something that is very important, something that is mandatory, something that is wajib. From the same is kutiba alaykumul qital, or kutiba alaykumul siyam. So kutiba means, it doesn't mean it was written. What does it mean? That it was made wajib upon you. So kitab is something that is wajib. Over here, it refers to their iddah. It refers to the waiting period, the prescribed waiting period after the death of the husband. So don't resolve to marry them until the kitab reaches ajalahu, its appointed time. Remember the meaning of ajal? It's either used for a period of time or a particular moment in time. Over here it refers to the moment in time, which is the end of the waiting period. So until the iddah is completely over, only then decide to do the nikah. Only then perform the nikah. And until then, do not send a direct proposal, do not make a firm decision, and do not promise either. وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا فِي أَنفُسِكُمْ. And know that indeed Allah knows what is in your hearts. Allah knows your feelings. Allah knows your decisions. Allah knows your thoughts. Therefore, فَاحْذَرُوهُ. Be conscious of him. Fear him. Be cautious of him. The word إِحْذَرُوهُ is from حَذَرَ. حَذَرَ. And حِذْر is to fear something or someone. And it is to try to keep safe. It is to try to stay safe from their anger, from their punishment, or from their harm. This is what حَذْر is. So for example, the word حِذْر is also used for precaution that an army takes before battle. What does that include? For example, making sure that they have their soldiers, that the soldiers are trained. Similarly, that they have enough ammunition, that they have enough means of transport. So all of that is what? Precaution. When the army has its precaution, what does it mean? That they will be safe from the danger of the enemy, from the threat of the enemy. That if the enemy knows that this army is very well prepared, they're going to think twice of attacking them. And if the enemy does attack, they will be able to defend themselves. So this is what Hidr is. Over here Allah says, be cautious of him. Be fearful of Allah. What does it mean? That don't do anything that would invite the anger of Allah, that would invite the punishment of Allah. Be cautious of Allah. And notice that this has come right after that he knows what is in your hearts. So be fearful of him, even with regards to your feelings, even with regards to your desires. Many times we think that if we say something, other people are going to find out about it. What are they going to think about me? So therefore, we refrain from saying certain things. But we entertain those thoughts in our heart, don't we? But the fact is that Allah knows what is in our hearts even. So if we are shy of people, and because of that shyness, because of that fear, we don't say some things, shouldn't we be shy of Allah and not entertain those thoughts in our hearts? If out of the fear of people, we don't verbalize some statements, out of the fear of Allah, should we not stop entertaining some thoughts in our hearts? وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا فِي أَنفُسِكُمْ. Allah knows what is in your hearts. فَاحْذَرُوهُ. So be cautious of him. Be fearful of him. Allah knows about the whispers even that are in our hearts, that shaitan puts in our hearts, or that our nafs whispers to us. Similarly, he also knows about the thoughts about other people that are in our hearts. We learn in Surah Qaf, ayah number 16, that وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ. Certainly, we have created the human being. Allah has created the human being. وَنَعْلَمُ مَا تُوَسْوِسُ بِهِ نَفْسُهُ. And we know what his soul whispers to him. We know exactly what his soul whispers to him. The secret thoughts, the quiet thoughts, that no one else hears. Only the person hears himself. Only the person hears those thoughts. Only the person himself hears those statements that he makes in his heart. Allah knows about those thoughts. Allah knows about those whispers. وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ حَبْدِ الْوَرِيدِ. and we are closer to Him than His jugular vein. So Allah knows about what is in our heart, and therefore we should be shy of Him. We should be fearful of Him. We should be cautious of Him. We should focus on cleaning our hearts. We should focus on the improvement of our hearts. That nothing that Allah disapproves of should be in my heart. Look at the context. That a man is thinking of sending a proposal to a woman. He is thinking about a woman who is non-mahram. He shouldn't think too much about her. And sometimes we see that people who do not even wish to get married to some people, still what are they doing? They're thinking about non-mahram. Or if they do wish to get married to them, and there is no scene of them getting married anytime soon. Sometimes children are very young, in their early teens, they're only 13, 14, and all they can think of is the boy whom they like, or the girl whom they like. And they're thinking about them, they're talking about them, they're sending text messages to them. فَحْذَرُوهُ. Hear him. Okay, parents don't know. Maybe your older siblings don't know. Maybe their parents don't know. But Allah knows. Yes, our feelings are not entirely in our control, but at least we can suppress them. At least we can try to control them. At least every time that the thought comes into our heart, into our mind, we can say that no, this is incorrect. You see, one is that the feeling comes to our heart, the thought comes to our heart. We don't have any control over the thought coming, over the feeling coming. But we have control over entertaining that feeling or not entertaining that feeling. It's up to us. You can sit for 2 hours and think about that person. Oh, what was he wearing? Look how he was talking. What was he eating? Where was he going? A person can spend 2 hours thinking about this. And another way is that as soon as a thought comes, he says, A'udhu Billah. Why am I thinking about a non-mahram? I shouldn't. And he makes, and she makes herself busy with something else. So we don't have any control over the thoughts that come to our hearts, but we do have control over whether or not we wish to entertain them, whether or not we wish to dwell on them. If we dwell on them, if we stay with them, if we entertain these thoughts, then we are at fault. Then we are blameworthy. And if the thoughts just come and we suppress them, then we're not blameworthy. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Al-Baqarah, Ayah 284, وَإِن تُبَدُوا مَا فِي أَنفُسِكُمْ أَوْ تُخْفُوهُ يُحَاسِبُكُمْ بِهِ اللَّهِ. Whether you show what is within yourselves or conceal it, whether you verbalize it or you hide it in your heart, Allah will bring you to account for it. Allah can question you. Allah can ask you, this person was not mahram to you. Why did you spend 2 hours thinking about them? Why did you spend half an hour thinking about them? Yes, a thought came into your heart. Okay, the thought was from shaitan. But why did you entertain that thought? Allah can bring you to account for it. فَيَغْفِرُ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ وَيُعَذِّبُ مَنْ يَشَاءُ. Then He will forgive whomsoever He wills and punish whomsoever He wills. Then it's left to the decision of Allah. He can forgive whoever He wills and He can punish whoever He wills. And it's not just thoughts about a non-mahram. Sometimes it is feelings of jealousy. It is feelings of envy. It is grudges, bad feelings, negative thoughts. Yes, we do have them, but it is incorrect to dwell upon them. Do not get over them. It is incorrect to start talking about them. Because what happens? If a person is jealous of another, what's going to happen? Either he's going to spend a lot of time thinking bad thoughts about that person, I'm going to say this and I'm going to do that, or I'm going to do this so that they are humiliated in front of the other person. Or he can go to the extent of talking to other people about that. You know, this person, I don't like them because of such and such reason. Or you know this person, she does this, she appears to be like this, but she's actually like this. So we see that bad thoughts don't just stay in the heart. They move on to the tongue, they move on to the actions. So therefore, we have to control the thoughts. Because Allah knows what is in our hearts فَاحْذَرُوهُ. And he's telling us to be fearful of him, to fear him with regards to our thoughts even. وَاعْلَمُوا. And know, أَنَّ اللَّهَ, that indeed Allah, He is غَفُورٌ, He is forgiving. If you have a bad thought and you're trying to suppress it, you're trying to do something to stop it, He will forgive you. But obviously if you're entertaining that thought and you're inviting the punishment of Allah, then Allah is ghafoor only to those who deserve the maghfirah. وَاعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ. And He is also حَلِيمٌ, He is also forbearing. Remember the name of Allah, Halim? We discussed about this name earlier, that حِلْم is tolerance, it is forbearance. That despite the fact that one has the ability to take revenge, he does not take revenge, but rather he forgives, he delays, he gives more chances. So despite our wrongdoing, despite the thoughts come to our hearts, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not punish us immediately. He gives us time to get over them. He gives us time to strive against them and to finish those thoughts. Allah is forgiving and He is also Halim. Let's listen to the recitation.
ولا جناح عليكم فيما عرضتم به من خطبة النساء أو أكننتم في أنفسكم. علم الله أنكم ستذكرونهن ولكن لا تواعدوهن سرا إلا أن تقولوا قولا معروفا ولا تعزموا عقدة النكاح حتى يبلغ الكتاب أجله واعلموا أن الله يعلم ما في أنفسكم فاحذروه واعلموا أن الله غفور حليم.
So basically we learn from this ayah that during the iddah, a man can only indirectly propose the widow. But he may also wait for the iddah to end and then send the proposal directly. And during the iddah, a man cannot promise her that he will marry her, nor can he perform the nikah, nor can he marry a woman who is in her iddah. We see that all of these conditions, the conditions of the iddah of the widow, they also apply to the iddah of the divorced woman. Which divorced woman? The one who has been given talaqul ba'in, who has been given the irrevocable divorce, the third divorce. Or she has taken khul. What? That during her iddah, do not send a proposal directly, only send a proposal indirectly, or wait until their iddah is over. Other scholars say that direct proposal may be sent to the woman who is in their iddah of talaqul ba'in, or who is in their iddah of khul. So there is a difference of opinion with regards to this. Some say that no, only indirect, just as the iddah of the woman who is a widow. And others say that no, direct proposals may also be made. We learn from a hadith that the Prophet ﷺ, he ordered Fatima bint Qais to remain in the house of Ibn Maktum for iddah when her husband Abu Amr ibn Hafs divorced her for the third time. Because we see that after the third divorce, the woman does not spend their iddah in the house of the husband, right? So she spent their iddah in the house of Ibn Maktum. And he said to her, tell me when your iddah comes to an end. When she finished their iddah, Usama ibn Zayd, the Prophet ﷺ's freed slave, asked to marry her. And the Prophet ﷺ married her to him. So after their iddah, what happened? The proposal was sent. But during their iddah, indirect proposal was sent. What was the indirect proposal? That when your iddah comes to an end, let us know. And when their iddah ended, then what happened? The proposal was sent directly. And as for the woman who has been given talaqul rajri, the revocable divorce, the first or the second divorce, it is not allowed for any man to send her a proposal directly or indirectly during her iddah. A woman who is in their iddah of the first divorce or the second divorce, no man is allowed to send her a proposal directly or indirectly. Why? Because she is still in the house of who? Of her husband. So how is it possible that another man is coming up and saying that I would like to marry you indirectly or directly? So only the actual husband is allowed to do that. Now, what if a woman who is in her iddah, what if she gets married to another person? What if? Whether she's a widow or she's a divorcee. What if she gets married during her iddah? Is her nikah going to be valid? No. The nikah is not going to be valid, and therefore the case is going to be taken to the court immediately, and their nikah is going to be abolished. It's going to be terminated. The man and woman will not be married anymore. After the completion of her iddah, then she may be allowed to get married to that man. And some scholars have gone to the extent of saying that she will not be allowed to marry that man anymore. She will not be allowed, because she has committed something that is absolutely haram. Marrying another person during her iddah, that's not acceptable at all. During the engagement, what is permissible? During the engagement, you see, when a man and woman are engaged, it means that they have decided that they will get married to each other. So obviously there is no relationship as of yet between the two. Now, just as you would deal with any other person with regards to some work that you're doing with them, for example, if you go to the marketplace and you are buying something and there is a person behind the till who is helping you purchase or who is telling you about what you should buy and what you should not buy or how you should take care of what you've bought, how would you deal with them? In a manner that is appropriate, with your hijab, in a manner that is appropriate. Similarly, if you have to deal with the prospective husband or with the person whom you're engaged with, you have to tell them about something or you have to speak to them about something that is absolutely necessary, you are allowed to do that, but obviously in a manner that is appropriate. Sometimes it happens that the mahram of the woman, like for example her father or her brother, he is there with her when something has to be decided, when something has to be agreed upon. So that may be done. So basically, nothing is allowed unless and until there is a need, there is a necessity. The question is about وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا فِي أَنفُسِكُمْ فَاحْذَرُوهُ, that there is a hadith which clearly states that whatever thoughts that come to a person's heart, a person is not accountable for them, as long as he does not verbalize them, as long as he does not act upon them. So the ayah that I quoted to you, which is the end of Surah Al-Baqarah, that whether you express or you don't express, you conceal or you reveal, Allah will bring you to account. The Sahaba, they got very concerned, and the Prophet ﷺ comforted them by saying a similar statement, that you're only accountable for what you say. But over here, what we're being told is that فَحْذَرُوهُ, be fearful, be cautious. If you dwell on that thought, if you entertain that thought for so long, what's going to happen? Eventually, it's going to turn into actions. So it's the cause of the action. So Allah will, if He wishes, He can ask you about it. So basically, the main thing that we're being told over here is that we should be fearful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with regards to our thoughts as well. And being fearful means suppressing those thoughts, not entertaining those thoughts. If a woman who is divorced or is a widow, if she decides to get married, and if she has daughters, what's going to happen to them? Remember that the father, the husband of your mother, even if he's not your father, you can never marry them. He can never marry you. So there is no problem of mahram, non-mahram, because he is the husband of your mother. And if the marriage is not consummated, then there's a different ruling with regards to that, but if the marriage is consummated between your mother and her husband, then he's like your mahram as well. What else do we learn from this ayah? For example, a woman, if she lives on her own in their iddah, and the only people in that town, in that city, she knew was her husband, and now she's left on her own, then she may go to another city where her parents are or her relatives are, to stay there over there, but the command is that she must stay in the house of the husband, unless if the situation does not allow at all. So in that case, the woman may spend their iddah elsewhere. Now, if the husband dies at home or the husband dies out of town while he was abroad, it doesn't matter. The woman will spend their iddah in the house of her husband. Any other question? If the nikah was done and the marriage was not consummated, what are the restrictions between the husband and wife? You see, consummation of marriage means that both of them, they've physically contacted each other or sexual intercourse. So as soon as that is done, then the marriage is consummated and the walima has to be done and the man has to give the mahar. And up until then, everything is permissible. They can talk, they can be alone, they can do anything that a husband and wife can do, as long as it is ma'roof. Remember that. You can never abandon ma'roof. If in your family, if in your culture, your parents don't like the fact that you go with your husband, although you're married to him, although the nikah has been done, then you can respect the will or the decision of your parents. Because if you don't respect that, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? The relationship between you and your parents is going to get affected. The relationship between your husband and your parents is going to be affected as well. It's only a matter of a few more days. And if a woman gets married during her iddah, then the marriage is going to be, the nikah is going to be abolished. And after their iddah, if she wishes to get married to that person, the nikah has to be performed again. And white and black specifically are not the two colors that a widow has to wear. She can wear any color, as long as it's not colorful and very bright. She can wear some plain clothes or some dull colored clothes. Because the hinting of the proposal, it can be done by the man himself and it can be done by one of his family members as well. Like for example, the Prophet ﷺ said that when you end your iddah, let us know. But who got married to her then? Usama. Now in the following verses, some more rulings pertaining to talaq have been mentioned. We see that when a man and woman get married, there are some conditions of nikah that must be fulfilled. And what are they? First of all, the presence of the wali of the girl. The presence of the wali of the girl, because there is no nikah without the wali. Similarly, the witnesses have to be there. Also, the words of the nikah, such as the wali saying to the prospective husband, to the man, that I gave my daughter or my sister in marriage to so and so. And what does the man say? I accept. What does the girl say? I accept. And another very important condition that must be fulfilled is the mahar. What is the mahar? It is the bridal gift. It is the gift that the husband gives to the wife at the time of marriage. And remember that the mahar should be given to the woman. It's a must. It's a condition. It can be given at the time of marriage, or it can be given afterwards as well, as long as it is acceptable to the woman and her wali. And the mahar becomes the property of the woman, not her husband, not her father. It is her property. It belongs to her. So we see that mahar is a mandatory gift. And what is the limit of the mahar, or what is the maximum or minimum of the mahar? There is no limit. Every person must give the mahar according to his capacity. Now, it doesn't mean that a rich man, a person who can afford to give a lot of mahar, is giving very little mahar. No. A person should give whatever suits him, whatever is his capacity. Now, at the occasion of divorce, at the time of divorce, how much mahar is a woman supposed to keep that she was given at the time of marriage? Or if she was supposed to be given the mahar at the time of marriage, but it was delayed for some reason. For example, the man said, inshallah, within a few months I will get this much money. I promise you that this is your mahar. As soon as I get it, it will be yours. But before she got the mahar, what happened? The man and woman ended up in a divorce. So if divorce happens, if a man divorces his wife, then what happens with the mahr? Who keeps the mahr? Does a woman keep it? Does it go back to the husband? What happens? Or if the man did not fully give the mahr to the woman, or if he did not even decide how much mahr he was going to give to the woman, what's going to happen at the time of divorce? Because the mahr is the right of the woman. And at the time of divorce, a woman should know who is keeping what. So we see that there are several scenarios. First of all, one scenario could be that the nikah was performed, the nikah was done, the mahr was also decided, it was given to the woman, and the marriage was also consummated. The man and woman were living together. Then who keeps the mahr? The woman keeps the mahr. How much? All of it, entirely. Because we learned earlier that لا تأخذوا مما آتيتموهن شيئا. Do not take back from the women anything that you have given them. So if the nikah was done, the mahr was fixed, the mahr was given, and or even if the mahr was not given but it was fixed and the marriage was also consummated, then the woman receives the mahr in full. Another situation, what could that be? That the nikah was done but the mahr, it was not decided. For example, the man is not sure if he's going to give 20,000 or 10,000 or 15. He's unsure. The mahr was not decided. And the marriage was also not consummated. Just the nikah took place. The man and woman are still living separately. The mahr is not decided. The marriage is not consummated. Then what's going to happen? Is the woman not going to get anything at the time of divorce? Just because no mahr was decided? No. She is going to be given something. And what is that something called? It's called mut'a talaq. It's called mut'a talaq. Mim ta ayn ta marbuta. Talaq. And what is that? It is an amount that is given to the woman which is according to the capacity of the man. Whatever that he can afford. If he can afford a lot, he should give a lot. If he can afford a little only, then he should give a little bit. But he must give something. Another scenario, which is that the nikah was done, the mahr was also decided. The man said, I'm going to give you 2,000, I'm going to give you 20,000. The mahr is decided. And the marriage was not consummated. Then what's going to happen? The woman is going to keep half of the decided mahr. Why half only? Because the marriage was not consummated. Another scenario, that the nikah was done, the mahr was not decided, and the marriage was consummated. Then what's going to happen? The woman is going to receive mahrul mithl. Mithl means similar. So what does it mean? That the mahr that is received by similar brides. Similar brides. Like for example, what is the tradition in the family? What did her sister get? What did her cousin get? All of these situations are going to be mentioned in the following verses, but one of them, which is that the nikah was done, the mahr was decided, the marriage was consummated, we have learnt of that earlier. So that's not going to be mentioned, but the following ones are going to be mentioned. لا جناح عليكم. There is no sin upon you. You're not at fault. There are no sinful consequences. If what? إن طلقتم. If you divorced. If you divorced who? النساء, the women. Meaning there is no sin upon the man if he decides to divorce his wife when ma, as long as لم تمسوهن, you have not touched them. Ma over here gives meaning of as long as. As long as you did not touch the women. تمسوهن is from mas, meme seen seen. What does mas mean? It literally means to touch. But mas is a polite expression. It's a figurative expression for sexual intercourse. And madam tamassuhunna means that you did not consummate the marriage with the woman. So there is no sin upon you for divorcing the woman before consummating the marriage with her. Or tafridu lahunna fariḍah. You settle for them an obligation. Tafridu is from fard. What does fard mean? An obligation. So something that is obligated, something that is fixed, something that is specified. What did you specify for them? Fariḍatan, an obligation. What is fariḍah? It is an obligatory duty It's a religious duty, something that a person has to perform. Just as there is salat that is faridah, there is sadaqah that is faridah. Similarly, the mahr, the bridal gift, is also a faridah. It is also something that is mandatory. Many times people neglect this. People don't focus too much on the mahr. They say that no, it's not important. However, it's a faridah, just as a salah is a faridah. Or they delay giving the faridah. But is it okay to delay the fard salah? It's not okay. Similarly, if there is no genuine reason, a person should not delay in giving the bridal gift as well. So there is no sin upon you if you divorce the women before consummating the marriage with them or before specifying the mahr for them. So what's the case over here? Nikah was done, marriage was not consummated, and the mahr was also not fixed. The mahr was not decided. If the man decides to divorce the woman, there is no sin upon him. However, since the talaq itself is something that is difficult for the woman, it is something that is emotionally difficult for the woman. There was no physical relationship between the man and woman, and the talaq happens. But because it is something emotionally difficult for the woman, therefore, the man should give something to the woman as a compensation. And what is that thing that he must give? وَمَتِّعُهُنَّ, and you all must benefit them. مَتِّعُ is from مِيم تَعَيْن. مَتَّع is a name for anything that a person can benefit from. So مَتِّعُهُنَّ, give them a gift of compensation. Give them something that they can enjoy. And because the word is مَتَّع, a person should give something that is actually a مَتَّع. He should give something that is a matar, meaning something that the woman can benefit from. How much should this be? عَلَى الْمُوسِعِ قَدَرُهُ. Upon the wealthy one, according to his capacity. The word مُوسِع, what's the root? وَاسِين عَيْن وُسْعَ. What does وُسْعَ mean? The capacity, the ability of a person. And مُوسِع, it begins with ميم. What does that mean? It's a noun. So مُوسِع is one who makes wusa, one who makes wasir, one who makes vast. What does he expand? What is he making vast? His wealth, his property. So musir is the one who has a lot of money. Musir is the one who is wealthy. It is the rich person, the affluent man. So the affluent man, the well-to-do person, he has to give the mata'a قَدَرُهُ according to his means. قَدَر is from the root letters قَاف دَال غَ, and قَدَر is the ability of a person, what a person is able to do, the capacity that he has. So the rich man will give according to what he can afford. And on the other hand, وَعَلَى الْمُقْتِرِ, and upon the poor man, قَدَرُهُ, his ability, meaning he will give whatever he can afford. The word muqtir is from the root letters qaf, ta, ra. And qatr literally means to be stingy. And muqtir is used for a person who is of straitened circumstances, a person who has limited resources. And because of his limited resources, what does he do? He becomes stingy in his spending. Because obviously, he's not going to go buy a bag for $500, or why? Because he can barely buy food. Even if he has $1,000, he's not going to spend half of his money on just a bag. He's going to spend that money instead on food, on rent, on something that is necessary. So muqtir is one who is of restricted income. From the same root, qatratun is used for dust, for darkness, for gloom, because many times when people are undergoing some financial problems, they become worried, and you can see the worry, the anxiety, the anxiousness on their faces. وَعَلَى الْمُقْتِرِ قَدَرُهُ. So we see that because the woman has suffered emotionally, therefore a compensation has to be given to her for the loss that she has incurred. The amount has not been fixed, but it has been left to the financial capacity of the man. مَتَاعًا, a benefit. How much is that going to be? Bil ma'roof, in the manner that is appropriate, in an appropriate way. Haqqan, it is a duty, meaning this is something that is wajib. Ala al-muhsinin, upon those who do ihsan. Someone who does ihsan, this is wajib upon him. Wajib upon him to do what? To give something to the woman whom he has given divorce to. Now, a person may say that the man should not give divorce to the woman in the first place. Why is he divorcing her? He married her, did not set the mahar, did not consummate the marriage with her. Why is he divorcing her? He doesn't even know her. He should marry her. He should compromise. He should try to sacrifice something and make do and accept her as his wife and just force the decision upon himself. But if you look at it, isn't it better that a relationship that a man is not fully involved in is terminated right at the beginning? Isn't it better? Imagine if the man is forced into this relationship, into this marriage. He does not like the woman. He does not like her. Or his heart is somewhere else. He's not interested in her. Or he thinks that it's not the right time for him to get married. He needs to put more time into his study or his work. Suppose he's training to become a doctor and he has to spend 24 hours at the hospital, for example, or 23 hours at the hospital. Can he really have a wife at that time? No. And if he does, it's going to affect his relationship. So if he thinks that it's not better for him to get married, it's better for him to divorce the woman at this point and not go and consummate the marriage. Because if he does, what's going to happen? It's going to make the situation worse for him and worse for the woman. Many times we see that young people are forced into marriage. And sometimes it's not just the women, it's not just the girls, it's also the boys who are forced into their marriages. And we see that they struggle for a few years, and maybe they have a child, maybe they have multiple children, and after some years they say, my heart was not in this from the very beginning. It was forced upon me. And because it was forced upon them, after a few years, when they break up, it makes the situation much worse for the girl and also for the boy. So we see that it is better, obviously it is encouraged, that once a person is married, then he should compromise on something. He should try his best to make do with whatever that he has and accept the spouse as he or she is. But if it's not working out and you can sense it from the very beginning, it's better to dissolve it at the initial stage. And if a person does give divorce to his wife at this stage without consummating the marriage, without specifying the mahar, then he has to give some matar. How much matar is that going to be? We see that in the early days of Islam, people would give slaves as matar to the woman. Why? Because a slave is someone whom you can benefit from. They can work for you. Similarly, we see that the amount would go up to 500 dirham. Or people would give camels according to their capacity, whatever they could afford. Today we can say that, for example, if a person is able to afford a car, he should give a car. If he can afford to give more than that or a little less than that, he should give whatever that he can. Because this is matar. This is something of value. Something that the woman can benefit from. Just as the mahar is not just $20-$30, it's not just a little bit amount from which a woman can only buy a pair of clothes. It's a good amount, it's a big amount, a few hundred or a few thousand. So similarly, the matar should also be something that is valuable, something that can really benefit the woman in some way. And if a person cannot afford, then we also see that sometimes even a pair of clothes was given. Even a pair of clothes was given to the woman as matar. Why? Because a pair of clothes also is something that a woman can benefit from. It is something that she has. And we see that even a pair of clothes, today you cannot buy it for less than 40, less than 50, like a good pair of clothes, less than 100. Generally, you cannot buy it for less than that much money. So, matar must be given to the woman. So we see that the gift that a man has to give, it is something serious. he has to give it. And therefore, the decision that he makes of divorcing the woman, that also he will think twice before making that decision. Let's listen to the recitation.
لا جناح عليكم إن طلقتم النساء ما لم تمسوهن أو تفرضوا لهن فريضة ومتعوهن على الموسع قدره وعلى المقتر قدره متاعا بالمعروف حقا على المحسنين.
Notice how the ayah ends, حَقًّا عَلَى الْمُحْسِنِينَ. The ruling, the law, we have been taught about that. But then it's left to us, how much ihsan do you want to do? This is something that the muhsineen will definitely do. How much ihsan do you want to do? Depending on how much you want to do, give the matah accordingly. Today we see that the complete opposite is done. At the time of divorce, if the man's family had given some gifts to the girl or the girl's family, what did they do? They take them back, or they demand for them to be returned. However, we see that at the time of divorce, it's the man who should give to the woman. Another scenario: وَإِن طَلَّقْتُمُوهُنَّ, and if you divorce them, مِن قَبْلِ أَن تَمَسُّوهُنَّ, before touching them, meaning before the consummation of marriage, the nikah was done, the marriage was not consummated, but وَقَدْ فَرَضْتُمْ لَهُنَّ فَرِيضًا, you did fix the mahr for them. You fixed the amount of the mahr. You fixed it, that you said it was going to be 20,000, you said it was going to be 10,000. So in this case, how much should the man give to the woman? فَنِصْفُ مَا فَرَضْتُمْ, then half must be given to the woman. So if he decided 20, he has to give 10. If he decided 10, he has to give 5. Illa except, meaning you have to give half, except in the situation where أَن يَعْفُونَ, that they forgive. يَعْفُونَ, who forgives? They over here refers to the women, that they say that they don't want it. For example, a woman says that, you know, I got married to him, okay, but there was no consummation at all. Let's say the man is in a different country, the woman is in a different country. So in this situation, the woman says, I don't need the mahar. I'm fine without it. I don't need it. So if they forgive, then it's not a must upon the man to give half of the mahar. Oh, or who forgives? Ya'fuwa, he forgives. Who forgives? Alladhi biyadihi uqdatun nikah, the one in whose hand is the marriage tie. What does it mean by the marriage tie? What does it mean by the marriage contract? The nikah. And what does it mean by the one in whose hand is the marriage contract? Meaning the person who has the choice of making that contract or dissolving that contract. Who is the one who has the right to dissolve the marriage contract? It's the husband. It's not the wali. The wali cannot come and say, my daughter is divorced from you. No. The man only can make the decision that I divorce you. So, الَّذِي بِيَدِهِ عُقْدَةُ النِّكَاحِ, who is the one who has control over their عُقْدَةُ of nikah? It's the husband. If he says, I accept, only then the marriage contract is made. If the man says to him, I marry my daughter to you, he says, I don't accept, is that marriage contract going to be established? No. The wali says over and over again, and the man says, no, I don't accept, the marriage contract is not going to take place. The marriage is not going to take place. Similarly, if the wali comes and says, divorce, it's not going to happen. So, الَّذِي بِيَدِهِ عُقْدَةُ النِّكَاحِ, is the husband. So what does it mean by this? That the husband forgives, the man forgives. He forgives what? He forgives the other half, meaning that he does not give only half, but he gives all of it. So giving half is not a must. That's the rule. But if the woman says she doesn't want it, then the man can keep all of the mahr. If the man says, no, I don't want to give you only half, or what am I going to do with the other half? You keep everything. Then what's going to happen? The woman can keep everything. The woman can be given the entire mahr. Wa an ta'fu, and if you all pardon, if you forgive. Who does you all refer to? You all over here is an address that is being made to the men, the man who divorces. If you pardon and you give the entire amount, it is أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى. It is much closer to taqwa. It's also said that ta'fu over here, because it's plural, it includes the men and the women. That if you men forgive and you give the entire mahr, or if you women forgive and you don't even take the half, then that is closer to taqwa. So we see over here that the ruling has been given, but if you overlook and forgive, if you overlook and are more generous, then it's better for you. So our deen teaches us to be those who give. Our deen encourages us to be on the giving end, not only being on the receiving end. Be the one who is giving. Be the one who is more generous, not just the one who is receiving and taking from the other. We see that in times of happiness, in good times, everybody gives and everybody enjoys giving. At the time of marriage, the husband gives a gift, the wife gives a gift, the mother-in-law gives a gift, the father-in-law gives a gift. Why? Because it's a happy occasion. But if you think of it, people are only giving at that time because giving makes them happy. The person who gives in the time of difficulty, in a difficult time, he is the one who actually gives for the sake of Allah. Because he's not giving to satisfy himself. He is giving to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, no matter what the situation is. So over here we see that even at the time of divorce, be the one who is giving to the other. And the woman can be like that, the man can be like that. Because if you give at that time, you're doing it for the sake of Allah. And therefore, it is closer to taqwa. It's a sign of taqwa. That when a person is upset with someone, when a person has been hurt because of someone, but despite that hurt, he still gives, what does that show? That he actually fears Allah. He has taqwa. وَلَا تَنْسَوُ الْفَضْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ, and do not forget the fadl that is between you all. What does fadl mean? Extra, surplus, more than the haqq. So yes, okay, the rule has been given, half, but don't forget the fadl that is between you. Don't forget to be extra generous. Don't forget to be gracious. Don't forget to be kind to the other. Don't forget the fadl that is between you. And لَا تَنْسَوُ الْفَضْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ has also been understood in another way. That don't forget the fadl that was there between you. Meaning don't forget the favor that you showed to each other before. That the man, in all of his generosity, he promised such a huge mahr at the time of the nikah. And then afterwards, when things don't work out as planned, he forgets everything. And he says, I have to give half. I don't want to give it. Or I'm encouraged to give full. I don't want to give it. So don't forget the fadl that you showed to each other before. Don't forget about the ihsan that you showed to each other before. We see that at the time of nikah, both the side of the man and the side of the woman, they show generosity to each other. For example, when the man comes with the proposal to the house of the girl, what happens? He brings gifts. Or his family brings gifts. And the woman, her family, what do? They honor, they respect, they serve, they treat them as guests. So what is this? Generosity. You're not really supposed to serve them. Okay, fine, you can show them a straight face and you can say, okay, fine. But you're extra nice, you're extra generous. What is this? Fadl. So all of that fadl that was there between the two of you, don't forget all of it now. Many times we see that one person hurts us only once, and we forget all the good that they have showed to us all those years. We forget everything. And this is extreme ingratitude. We see over here that even at the moment of separation, remember the good days. Remember the good days. Don't remember the bad days. We never forget of reminding our favors to other people, but we forget remembering favors. We don't forget to remind the other of the favors that we've done on them. And we forget the favors that they have shown to us. This is something that is highly discouraged. We learn in Surah Al-Baqarah, Ayah 264, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تُبُطِلُوا صَدَقَاتِكُمْ بِالْمَنِّ وَالْأَذَى. O you who have believed, do not invalidate your charities with reminders of injury, by reminding the other of what you've done to him. Instead, what should we do? We should focus on the good that we have received from others. If you have done ihsan upon someone, you've done it for Allah. And if he has done ihsan upon you, don't forget it. Don't forget the ihsan of other people. No person is perfect. No human being is perfect. If 99% of the time they're good, or if 99% of their qualities you appreciate, you like, there is going to be that 1% that you don't like. That one quality, that one trait that you disagree with, that makes you upset. No human being is perfect. Don't focus on the 1%, focus on the 99%. Don't focus on the bad, focus on the good. Don't focus on the bad times, focus on the good times. So لا تنسوا الفضل بينكم. Don't forget the fadl that is between you. إِنَّ اللَّهَ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ بَصِيرٌ. Indeed, Allah is seeing of whatever that you do. If you do ihsan, if you're generous, or if you're not generous, Allah knows about it. So we learn from this ayah that we should not forget the favors of other people upon us. And secondly, we should not forget doing ihsan upon others either. We should not forget to do ihsan upon the other. At divorce, people forget all the good that they have enjoyed, and they only remember the bad times. Even if the divorce happens after 20 years, after 25 years, what is it that the people will remember? The bad times, not the good times. That's all that they will talk about. But over here, we're being told to be positive. Have a positive outlook, have a positive approach, because only when you're positive can you be generous. The moment you become negative, then you become selfish. Then you think about only your own personal benefit, and you don't think about other people. So even at this time, be positive and be generous. إِنَّ اللَّهَ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ بَصِيرٌ. Allah is watching what you do. Even if the other person does not acknowledge what you're doing, Allah is watching. Allah knows about your efforts. Allah knows about your generosity. Allah knows about your thinking. Let's listen to the recitation.
وَإِن طَلَّقْتُمُوهُنَّ مِن قَبْلِ أَن تَمَسُّوهُنَّ وَقَدْ فَرَضْتُمْ لَهُنَّ فَرِيضَةً فَنِصْفُ مَا فَرَضْتُمْ إِلَّا أَن يَعْفُونَ أَوْ يَعْفُوَ الَّذِي بِيَدِهِ عُقْدَةُ النِّكَاحِ وَأَن تَعْفُوا أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى وَلَا تَنْسَوُا الْفَضْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ إِنَّ اللَّهَ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ بَصِيرٌ.
You see where Allah says لَا تَنْسَوُا الْفَضْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ. Sometimes the divorce of two individuals leads to the divorce of two families, even if they're blood relatives. Sometimes if the marriage is between families, for example, cousins get married, and because the relationship didn't work out, they end up in a divorce. What happens? Their parents, who may be siblings, they completely cut off from each other. They don't meet each other, they don't greet each other, and if they do happen to encounter each other at a gathering or something, they won't even say salam. They won't even acknowledge the presence of the other. They will completely disregard them. But Allah says, لَا تَنْسَوُ الْفَضْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ. Okay, fine, there was divorce, but why are you forgetting everything else? Yes, divorce is something that is very painful, very difficult, but why should you forget all the good times? Why should you forget the good time that you have enjoyed with your sibling, with your brother, with your sister? Okay, yes, your children didn't get along, but you could still get along. لَا تَنْسَوُ الْفَضْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ. Don't forget the good times that you enjoyed. Only those two people have divorced. You have not been divorced. إِنَّ اللَّهَ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ بَصِيرٌ. And sometimes we see that one party or one side tries to do ihsan upon the other. They try to have good relationships with them. They try to say salam. They try to greet them at Eid, invite them over. But the other side is not willing to accept you. It happens. So take solace in the fact that Allah is watching your actions. Allah is watching. Allah knows how much effort I am putting in, what I feel, how I am. Therefore, He is going to recompense. He is going to reward. إِنَّ اللَّهَ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ بَصِيرٌ. حَافِظُوا عَلَى الصَّلَوَاتِ وَالصَّلَاةِ الْوُسْطَى وَقُومُوا لِلَّهِ قَانِتِينَ. Maintain with care the obligatory prayers, and in particular, the middle prayer, and stand before Allah devoutly obedient. حَافِظُوا. حَافِظُوا is a command. It's an instruction that is being given to all believers. And notice that the context is of divorce and iddah and a person who has died, leaving behind a widow. Because these issues, these matters, when a person gets stuck in them, once a person starts discussing them, there is no limit to that. There is no end to that. And especially when a person is going through divorce or when a family member is going through divorce, all that he can think about is how sad the situation is, how miserable the situation is. And during this, what does Allah say? حَافِظُوا عَلَى الصَّلَوَاتِ. All of you, guard your salat. Preserve your salat. Protect your salat. The word حَافِظُوا is from حِفْظ. And حِفْظ means to preserve something. It is to protect and preserve something so that it does not get wasted. حِفْظ is to protect, to take care of something. And the word حَافِظُ also gives a meaning of مُدَاوَمَة, which is to keep up with something and maintain something. To constantly do something, to continue doing something. So حَافِظُ عَلَى الصَّلَوَاتِ, and الصَّلَوَاتِ is a plural of صَلَاة. And al over here gives a meaning of specific salawat, specific prayers. So it refers to the 5 daily prayers. That no matter what happens in your life, even if you yourself are going through divorce, or even if a relative is going through divorce, no matter what happens, don't neglect your salah. حَافِظُوا عَلَى الصَّلَوَاتِ. And in particular with salat, وَالصَّلَاةِ الْوُسْطَى. Especially guard the middle prayer. The word wusta is feminine of the word awsat, and awsat is from waw, seen, ta. Awsat is the middlemost, that which is in the mid, that which is in the middle, central. Wusta is a feminine of that. Why is a feminine word used over here? Because it's an adjective of as-salat. As-salat ends with a tamabuta, so it's a feminine noun. So the word wusta gives a meaning of that which is central, that which is in the middle. And remember that ummatan wasatan, we learned earlier in the second juz, refers to what? Ummah that is in the middle, and also ummah that is best. Wasat also gives a meaning of best. So figuratively, the word also means best or most important. Because that which is in the middle is best. The best age is the age of youth, between childhood and old age. So what is this middle salah? What is this central salah? Or what is this best salah? Out of the 5 daily prayers, Salat al-Wusta refers to the Asr salah. Why? Because there are 2 salah before it and 2 salawat after it. Fajr and Zuhr before it and Maghrib and Isha after it. So it's right in the middle. And secondly, it's called Wusta, best. Why? Because it is of great importance. It has great importance in Islam, in our deen. So we see over here that guarding the prayer, preserving the prayer, is something that is very important for the believer. We learn that 50 prayers, 50 salawat, were initially prescribed in the Muslim Ummah. When the Prophet ﷺ went on Mi'raj, what happened? 50 prayers were initially prescribed. And then on the encouragement of Musa alayhi salam, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi salam kept going back, and eventually the number came down to 5. And after this, any person who maintains and properly performs these 5 salawat, he will get the reward of praying all those 50 salawat. Provided that he does the hifadha, he does the hifz of the 5 salawat. Now the question is, what does it mean by hifz salah? What does it mean by guarding the prayer? We know that guarding the prayer first of all means performing the salah properly, fulfilling all of its pillars, fulfilling all of the conditions, all of the prerequisites, performing the salah in the correct manner, in the proper manner, following the sunnah of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Also, guarding the salah means performing the prayer on time. Do not delay the salah. Do not delay the salah from its proper time and pray it when the time of the salah has actually gone. For example, a person prays Zuhr salah at the time of Asr salah. That is what? That is not guarding the prayer. Guarding the prayer means performing the Zuhr salah in the time of Zuhr salah, within that time, not delaying it from that time. We learn from a hadith that is reported in both Bukhari and Muslim that Ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu, he asked the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which deed is dearest to Allah? Which deed is the best deed in the sight of Allah? And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam replied, as-salatu ala waqtiha, to offer the prayers at their proper times. And proper times means what? To perform the salah within its time. Do not pray after its time or before its time. I asked, what is the next good deed? What is the next action which is best in the sight of Allah? And he replied, al-jihad fi sabilillah, to participate in jihad in Allah's cause. I asked, what is the next in goodness? And he replied, birrul walidain, to be good and dutiful to your parents. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, he then added, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam told me these words, and had I asked more, the Prophet would have told me more. If only I had asked him more questions. So this is a hadith that is reported in both Bukhari and Muslim. So guarding the salah includes performing the salah on time. And guarding the salah includes praying the salah constantly, meaning not missing out on some salah. Because it's to guard the salah, to not miss out on even one, to not delay even one. وَالصَّلَاةُ الْوُسْطَى, and in particular, guard which salah? The Asr salah, because it's the midmost salah. Now, the evidence for Salat al-Wusta being Asr salah was, first of all, the linguistic evidence that I told you, that Wusta is that which is central, so Salat al-Asr is central. It's best because of its great importance. We learned that the Prophet ﷺ, during the Battle of Ahzab, what happened in the Battle of Ahzab? The Muslims had to dig the trenches. And upon digging the trenches, they also had to guard the trenches, because the enemy was... Where was the enemy? Right across the trenches, right? So they also had to constantly guard the trenches. So the Prophet ﷺ said, شَغَلُونَ عَنِ الصَّلَاةِ الْوُسْطَى صَلَاةِ الْعَصْرِ مَلَأَ اللَّهُ قُلُوبَهُمْ وَبُيُوتَهُمْ نَارًا. They, meaning the disbelievers, they made us very busy from performing the middle prayer, the Asr prayer. Because they had to stay over there for so long that the proper time was gone. May Allah fill their hearts and houses with fire. And this is a hadith that is mentioned in Musnad Ahmad, and a similar hadith is also reported in Sahih Muslim. So from this we learn that Salatul Wusta is Salatul Asr. Now why is Salatul Asr mentioned here in particular? Aren't all of the five daily prayers important? Of course they are. But when one is mentioned specifically, it shows that guarding that, performing that, is extremely important, is much more important. What is the importance of the Asr Salah? We learn from a hadith, the Prophet ﷺ said, that مَنْ فَاتَتْهُ صَلَاةُ الْعَصْرِ فَكَأَنَّمَا غُتِرَ أَهْلَهُ وَمَا لَهُ. Whoever misses the Asr prayer will be like the one who has lost his family and money. The one who misses his Asr Salah, it's as though he has lost his entire family, it's as though he has lost his entire money. Many times, what is it that makes us neglect our Asr Salah? It's either because we're busy in our work, or we're busy with our families. And what does the hadith tell us? That it's as though you've lost it. You've lost all of your money. You've lost all of your family. Also, we learn from another hadith that on a cloudy day, perform the Asr prayer early. Why? So that you don't miss it. Because Obviously, at that time, there were no clocks. So if it was cloudy since morning, how would you know it's Zuhr time or Asr time? Or how would you know it's almost Maghrib time? You can't tell. So the Muslims were told that perform the Asr prayer early. For whoever misses the Asr prayer will have his good deeds wasted. And this is a hadith that is considered as sahih. So we see that Asr Salah is of great importance. Asr is the time when the day is coming to an end. People are either wrapping up their work for the day or they are busy with their families. And sometimes a person is busy with his family life. And if it's such an issue, such as divorce, then what happens? Once a person is caught up in this problem, in this issue, then he neglects the salah. Sometimes a fight may continue for so long that a person doesn't even realize and he has missed the proper time. In the middle of these verses, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reminds us of the importance of salah. Another hadith tells us, which is mentioned in Sahih Bukhari, that whoever prays the two cool prayers, Salla al-Bardaini. Which are the two cool prayers? The Asr and Fajr. Asr Salah and Fajr Salah. Why? Because Fajr, obviously, it's a time that is very cool. And also in the intangible sense, if you miss your morning, you miss out on a lot. Just challenge yourself to stay awake one morning and you'll see the benefits. Really, don't sleep after Fajr, even for 15 minutes, even for half an hour, and you'll see the barakah in your time, in your day. So whoever prays the two cool prayers, what are they? Fajr and Asr. And Asr also because the sun is not at the top, it's not Zuhur. So therefore, the day is not that hot at that time. So whoever prays the two cool prayers, he will go to paradise. He will go to Jannah. Also we learn from another hadith, that إِنَّكُمْ سَتَرَوْنَ رَبَّكُمْ كَمَا تَرَوْنَ هَذَا الْقَمْرَ لَا تُضَامُونَ فِي رُؤْيَتِهِ. You people will see your Lord as you see this full moon, and you will have no trouble in seeing Him. The full moon, when it's up in the sky, can you see it without any difficulty? Yes. And can everybody see it? Yes. Whoever is there can see it if they try to look up. Even if there's a big crowd of people, still you can see, because all you have to do is look up and you can see the moon clearly. And full moon, you can see it clearly. So you will see your Rabb, you will see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala just as you see the full moon today. فَإِنِ اسْتَطَعْتُمْ أَلَّا تُغْلَبُوا عَلَىٰ صَلَاتٍ قَبْلَ طُلُوعِ الشَّمْسِ وَصَلَاتٍ قَبْلَ غُرُوبِ الشَّمْسِ فَافْعَلُوا. So if you can avoid missing through sleep or becoming busy a prayer before Fajr and a prayer before sunset, which is Asr, then you must do so. A prayer before sunrise and a prayer before sunset, which is the Asr Salah and the Fajr Salah. So if you can avoid missing the Salah, then must do so. You must try to avoid missing the Salah. Because only if you avoid missing these two prayers, then you will be able to see Allah. Then you will be able to see Allah clearly. So if you want to see Allah, then guard this prayer. وَقُومُوا لِلَّهِ قَانِتِينَ. And stand for Allah as devoutly obedient. قَانِتِينَ, as we have learned the meaning earlier, قَانِتِينَ is from قُنُوت, and قُنُوت, as you know, means obedience. And it also means to stand. The word قُنُوت also means calmness, stillness. So what does it mean by قُومُوا لِلَّهِ قَانِتِينَ? Stand for Allah as devoutly obedient, meaning stand with humility, stand with khushu'. Perform the salah with khushu'. That your heart, your mind, your concentration, your focus should be on who? On Allah, not on other things, not on other people, not on what else is going on. Lillah, for Allah. And show humility, obedient in front of Allah. What does it mean by obedience in front of Allah in salah? Showing humility. This has also been understood as قُمُوا لِلَّهِ قَانِتِينَ, meaning stand in salah while being still, with sukut, with stillness, with calmness. We learned that Zayd bin Arqam, he said that we used to speak to each other sometimes during salah. Before, in the early stages, we used to speak to each other sometimes during salah. But when this was revealed, قُمُوا لِلَّهِ قَانِتِينَ, we were commanded to be silent and were forbidden to talk. So we see that in salah, qunut means to show humility, to have khushur, but it also means to become still. Stillness of the body and stillness of the tongue. And stillness of the tongue does not mean that you don't say the words of salah. Obviously you are supposed to say them with your tongue and not just in your mind. But what it means is that a person should not talk with other people. We learned that once Muawiyah ibn Hakam, he spoke during the salah, and the Prophet ﷺ said to him that the ordinary speech people indulge in is not appropriate during the prayer. The prayer involves only tasbih. It involves only takbir and remembering Allah. So salah should have tasbih, takbir, and the dhikr of Allah, remembering Allah, on the tongue and also in our hearts. So salah must have humility. Let's listen to the recitation.
حافظوا على الصلوات والصلاة الوسطى وقوموا لله قانتين.
So we learn from this ayah that all five prayers must be performed properly. A person must guard all of the five prayers. Sometimes we focus a lot on just certain salah. For example, if we're at school and if the adhan goes at 1:30, we want the class to end at 1:30 and we want to go to the masjid and pray the salah with the men. However, if we're at home, what do? We delay till 3, we delay till 3:30. Hifz of salah means praying the salah within its proper time. Within its proper time. So if because of some reason, and this is a very important reason, that all of us are sitting together in a gathering of knowledge, studying the Quran, and if for that reason we're not able to pray salah with the rest of the masjid, then we can pray within the proper time of salah in jama'ah together, in congregation together. Alright? Understood? As long as it is within the proper time. And if it's more than 2-3 people, then why not pray in jama'ah? And remember that iqamatu salah, with the condition of iqamatu salah being performing the salah in congregation, that is especially for the men. But for the women, since all of us are together anyway, might as well pray together and get more reward. That is benefit for us. But it's not mandatory upon the women. Remember that. So guarding all the five prayers is important. Not just a few salah. But special importance must be given to the Asr salah. And from the hadith that I mentioned to you, that if we wish to see our Rabb clearly, then we should also focus on performing the Fajr salah properly and at its proper time. Not delay it. Really, how much difference is it going to make if you wake up 15 minutes early, 20 minutes early, half an hour early? All of Ramadan you woke up early, before Fajr, so you can do it for the rest of the year as well. Because the benefit is great. Imagine seeing Allah clearly. And also we learn the etiquette of salah, that when a person is praying the salah, he should pray with qunut, with humility, with khushur, with calmness. Just imagine, when you're meeting somebody whom you love, when you're talking to someone whom you love, do you ever speak with your mind being elsewhere? You don't do that. And if you try to do that, other people get so upset. They get very upset. And they sometimes just stop you in the middle and they're like, what did I just say? Just to test if you were listening or not. So, if you really love someone, you pay attention to the conversation that you're having with them. You don't say it mindlessly. You know about what you're saying, and you say it with your heart. Similarly, when we're praying salah, don't just say the salah A to Z with no concentration, with no heart, but say it with consciousness. And for this, it is very important to know the meaning of salah. Because only when you know the meaning of salah, can you focus on the salah. Because otherwise, how do you know about what you're saying? How can you pay attention? How can you focus? You can't. So, قُومُ لِلَّهِ قَانِتِينَ. So the etiquette of salah is to perform it with humility, with concentration, with devotion. Let's listen to the recitation from the beginning.
وَالَّذِينَ يُتَوَفَّوْنَ مِنْكُمْ وَيَذَرُونَ أَزْوَاجًا يَتَرَبَّصْنَ بِأَنفُسِهِنَّ أَرْبَعَةَ أَشْهُرٍ وَعَشْرًا فَإِذَا بَلَغْنَ أَجَلَهُنَّ فَلَا جُنَاحَ عَلَيْكُمْ فِيمَا فَعَلْنَ فِي أَنفُسِهِنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ والله بما تعملون خبير ولا جناح عليكم فيما عرضتم به من خطبة النساء أو أكننتم في أنفسكم علم الله أنكم ستذكرونهن ولكن لا تواعدوهن سرا إلا أن تقولوا قولا معروفا ولا تعزموا عقدة النكاح حتى يبلغ الكتاب أجله واعلموا أن الله يعلم ما في أنفسكم فاحذروه واعلموا أن الله غفور حليم لا جناح عليكم إن طلقتم النساء ما لم تمسوهن أو تفرضوا لهن فريضة ومتعوهن على الموسع قدره وعلى المقتر قدره متاعا بالمعروف حقا على المحسنين وإن طلقتموهن من قبل أن تمسوهن وقد فرضتم لهن فريضة فنصف ما فرضتم إلا أن يعفون أو يعفو الذي بيده عقدة النكاح وأن تعفوا أقرب للتقوى ولا تنسوا الفضل بينكم إن الله بما تعملون بصير حافظوا على الصلوات والصلاة الوسطى وقوموا لله قانتين